Murray, vice chair Navarro, standing in for Senator Duncan until he gets off the plane. Michelle Castaneda, Barbara Huff, and that's it for members. We also have our consultant, Jeff Malik. We sent out some surveys to local governments, which are being compiled. Some of them have come back in, but they're not. They have not all come back in yet and haven't been compiled. We're looking at some long-term plans on how to get a hold of long-term health care costs. Hopefully come out with a policy and a plan that will save both the state and its citizens money over the years. I'd like to invite all the teleconference sites that are online today. So far we have Soldotna, Valdez, Kodiak, Homer, Juneau, Valdez. That's probably it. Anyone else that's online that has someone who wishes to testify, please let us know, and we'll rotate from site to site as we take testimony. Starting off this morning, I'll ask any of the task force members if they have any comments before we get into the report from our consultant. Okay, Mr. Malik, I'll turn it over to you for your report.
What I'd like to do is just briefly set the stage for these hearings and the type of input that the task force is looking for from the public. The task force has been looking at for the last number of months the increasing costs of health care in the state of Alaska and the contributing factors. It's been determined that there are a number of contributing factors, all not standing or being a single villain, but all contributing together. And out of that, there are some conceptual ideas to look at ways to stem the long-term, fast-rising health care costs in the state of Alaska. In the packet that was sent out to municipalities, health care providers, and some private sector employers, it specifically asked for responses to questions in a questionnaire and listed four areas of specific consideration. I'd like to touch on those four areas, and those that are testifying today, if we could touch on those areas and maybe some ideas that those testifying have regarding health care costs and the ability to stem the rising tide. Thank you. The first is that we saw last year a number of factors that could possibly be implemented by the state and have far-reaching effects. And looking greater into those, things like utilization review standards, whereby the standard of care or the medical necessity using a baseline parameters or general parameters to be used within the state, combined, therefore, controlling or looking at utilization of health care. Secondarily, aligned with that also is the health care provider reimbursement schedules, looking at pricing and utilization. Aside from that, the ability to use a statewide healthcare purchasing pool or the ability to increase the buying power within the state by purchasing healthcare through an efficient mechanism or financing vehicle. And last but not least, some discussion has been led through the task force regarding utilization review standards, that is, standards used by firms that are doing utilization review, and some discussion about the possibility of needing to act on that particular scenario, whereby the firms that are doing that, they're all using a number of different standards, they're all developed their own, and using a lot of different quality criteria, therefore impacting possibly the cost of care in Alaska and how it's delivered. So really, three major areas, utilization of health care and the guidelines for that, health care provider reimbursement schedules, and the financing or ability to finance. Also coming to light is things of the ability to deliver care, especially in the rural areas, and also the possibility of having example overbuilding or potential overbuilding in the future. These are all areas that the task force has somewhat identified in looking for additional comment from the private and public sector to give us some additional insight as we move forward with the task force to look to make recommendations to the legislature early next year.
Thank you, Jeff. Also mentioned that Representative Boyer and Karen Perdue, two other task force members, have joined us. And with that, we'll go to the public testimony, and I'd like to begin using the prerogative of the chair, Ms. Soldotna. So we'll have the first participant in Soldotna.
This is Jerry Neer, and we have a quorum of three here, and we were hoping you wouldn't choose us first, but being a small guy in the room, they pointed to me, so I need to leave this one out. I had a call from Dave Gray, I guess, the other day, and he indicated this hearing was going to be today, and I've been in the insurance business and dealing with this health insurance and hospital cost thing for some time. And right now we have sort of a thing that we're working on in this peninsula to see if there is a better way to do it, you know, on behalf, similar to the problem that you folks face. And just a few items in regard to rising hospital costs, something that not only affects us here, but also all over the country. And incidentally, there are parts of this country that have higher costs than we do here, even though we're a long ways from the mainstream of economics in this country, mostly the big city. But one of the things that I think we need to take a look at, and that's what legal concerns do to driving up the cost of our health delivery system. And a lot of the people in the medical care business are practicing what, for sake of a better word, that we call defensive medicine. So it can kind of guard them in the event that there's any problem that they have that to fall back on. The other thing I think we need to look at is utilization. That in anything such as the costs that are represented in operating a hospital, there are certain costs that you have we call fixed costs. And you pay those whether you have bed occupancy or not. And I think if there is a way that we can elevate that, that you'd have a lower cost on a per patient basis. We need to take, I think, a better look in what it would require to encourage people to have their medical needs taken care of either locally or within the state of Alaska. Because one of the things that's been evident to myself in the years of being in the insurance business, and on a lot of applications and in the inquiry on health histories, a fair amount of our medical care needs are being taken care of in other parts of the country. There is a whole spectrum of regulations that hospitals must comply with. Some are federal, some are state, some may be local, but there's layer upon layer, and the compliance for all those regulations are one of the things that drives the cost up. Staffing, our hospital here is manned on a round-the-clock basis. There are many, many different job descriptions there that have to be dealt with. And the staff of the hospital means just a wide range of talent. And maybe you don't have maximum utilization on all those people unless you have a high occupancy. There's probably no building you can ever design and build that costs as much on a square foot basis as a hospital does. And maybe we can take a look at that also. Some of the equipment that is utilized today for special kinds of treatment, probably underutilized, it's very, very costly. Maybe there could be a consolidation of that or better utilization of that. That's what I can address so far as the hospital costs and how it contributes to this overall thing and healthcare costs. We have some other things out there. One is, I'm sure we're all aware of, that we have an aging of the population, both nationwide and also here in Alaska. The average age in Alaska is generally going up. We have more people that have need for care than we would need at their population and maybe come in at a younger age. The big problem with the insurance industry is simply this, that we do not insure everybody. Every time an insurance application is written, the insurance company goes through that in detail and selects against the kind of risks that they wish to insure. So we have, in large part, a healthcare delivery system that right out of the box eliminates the folks from the program that need it most. Also, we have a lot of young people that cannot afford the cost of insurance because we don't have that stable of an economic base here, and those monies are just not available for them to pay for it. There's a study that's been going on in Oregon, I just called the Oregon Study, and it's an attempt to reallocate the dollars that go into medical care on a basis of what is most important down to what may be least important. It's something that I think we ought to take a look at. To bring health insurance costs down, of course, they're tied in very much with the kind of costs that they're designed to pay. And if the insurance company has to pay the bill, they need to get the premium dollars from somebody. And I'm not sure how many insurance companies are doing business in Alaska, but there has to be several hundred. One of the ways that we do it in the industry is to eliminate the kinds of coverages that we call the low deductible type plan. That, in essence, really is not an insurance plan. What it really is a medical expense reimbursement plan. And if we can get people to understand what insurance is really supposed to be, we can cut the insurance cost in half. Then, internally in the policy structure itself, there are certain things and certain procedures that we might put a cap on rather than say that you pay all the costs. I think it goes without saying that for most of us, if we can find somebody else that can pay the cost for something, that we would ask for the best thing that's out there. I've already mentioned that there needs to be some education on the part of the public as to what insurance really was designed to take care of in the first place. And I liken it to just maybe taking care of your home or your automobile or some other piece of equipment. There are certain costs that you incur that you could just construe as maintenance, and we all pay that. We could look at our healthcare system that same way and look at maintenance as something the individual pays, but if it's something that's very major, well, then that's what your insurance was designed to cover. Read my notes here a little bit. I've read the Duncan bill 6 or 8 months ago, and one of the things I think we need to be concerned on in the state of Alaska is we have adequate monies in the state government. All the public employee groups from local on through the state have been able to organize so that their health care costs are being paid for out of taxpayers' dollars. I think there needs to be some consideration if the state's going to pay 100% of all the health care needs for all these people. There needs to be some consideration for the rest of the people that are out there working from 8 to 5 every day trying to make the state what it is. And we need to develop some incentives, as I mentioned earlier, to keep people in the state of Alaska, instead of having that exodus of capital. We can keep the dollars that are already going into our health care system. I'm sure they're more than adequate to take care of the needs of all the people who live up here. I think with that, I'll just close, and if I come up with something else, I'll add it in later, hopefully. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Are there any comments or questions by task force members? Okay, if not, I'm going to rotate to Anchorage, and we'll take the first participant here in Anchorage who wishes to testify, Sister Donna Taylor.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sister Donna Taylor. I'm the administrator of Providence Hospital here in Anchorage. I appreciate the opportunity to have some time with you this morning. Everyone complains about the costs of health care, and it seems to be a consensus that health care costs are too high. I'd like to talk about three things this morning. First, I'd like to talk about the situation of healthcare delivery in our state, some of the undiscussed components of healthcare costs, and some suggestions for dealing with the issue. Most often, the providers of healthcare, hospitals and physicians, get the blame for increased healthcare costs. In our state, healthcare is always provided, even when the recipients can't pay for it. The citizens of Alaska do not perceive that there's a problem with our delivery system. They don't complain because they receive care. Legislators don't have a sense that there's a problem because their constituents don't complain to them. We in this state have no state health plan. We have not made a determination about our delivery system in terms of access, in terms of service or payment. If we want specific levels of service, coverage and access, then we must be willing to pay for them. Healthcare is more expensive in Alaska, but so are our real estate costs, our food costs, our labor costs, and our general cost of living. Receiving healthcare outside the state is encouraged. This is unfortunate. If we kept our healthcare within the state, we could help keep costs down. The money that leaves the state would go to spreading the overhead. A good deal of the business leaves the state from southeast. In fact, state employees are encouraged to receive care outside. This is disturbing because we all understand that the cost of doing business in Alaska is higher. Do we want to provide health care in our state? If we do, we need to support it. We need to support it at Alaska prices. One of the first steps in managing health care costs, I think, is to keep the patients who can be cared for in Alaska, in Alaska. I'd like to speak about some of the factors which influence health care costs. As I have said, many people feel that the providers are at fault. I'd like to discuss some components. Labor. The labor costs of providers are high. We must compete in a scarce market with comparable salaries and benefits, and then add the Alaskan cost factor. Expectations. Society's expectations of our delivery system are extremely high. People want everything, all the time, and at very little or no cost. Our expectations have become such that we think we should always feel well and that we should rarely die. We want the best. Cost is no consideration. Technology. This allows us to do many things most of the time, but it's expensive. We have no limitations and we don't ration. Deductions. A number of purchasers fail to reimburse providers the true cost of providing care. They impose arbitrary payment rates, failing to pick up their fair share of health care costs. Key among these purchasers are Medicare, Medicaid, CHAMPIS, and Veterans Administration. We call these deductions. Charity. Our state does not have a county health system. Those who cannot afford care are cared for in their local communities by the local providers. These providers are not reimbursed for charity care. And debt. In addition to deductions and charity, bad debt adds to the provider's dilemma. The practice of cost shifting does occur. Some purchasers are assessed more to make up the difference. I know that the legislature is concerned about the rising costs of the state employees' medical plan. The benefits are generous, and it's unpopular to reduce them. The information that you shared with us about the costs of the plan, I think, needs to be a bit more specific. It does not appear to give an accurate picture of what is occurring. Aggregating the numbers at cost increases per capita does not appear to give a true picture. We need to look at cost increases from the perspective of price, utilization, and enrollment. How much have costs increased due to the increased enrollment, either from employees, dependents, or retirees? How much have costs increased due to increased occasions for use of the service? I believe if we were to analyze Alaskan healthcare costs from the perspective of price, utilization, and enrollment, add the Alaskan cost factor, we would find that our costs are very close to the cost nationally. Certainly, we're all concerned about healthcare costs. I'd like to make some suggestions, which I feel might be of assistance in identifying the kind of care that we want to receive here in our state and how we might arrive. I'd like to suggest that we develop a state health plan. Let's identify the care that we wish to provide the delivery system that we would support, and then provide the funds to do that. I'd encourage you to work closely with the providers in looking at costs and looking at possible solutions. I'd suggest that you take a look at the true reasons for the cost increases in the state employees plan. I'd suggest that you might want to look at the employees' health plan from the perspective of increased risk sharing by the user. Look at the possibility of increased deductibles, but the possibility of second opinions. Require that health care within the state is given if that care can be given. And I think it would be important to look at all of the contracts to be sure that you're receiving the low-cost provider in the community. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to comment and assure you that my staff and I will be available to assist at any time. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister. Could we also get a copy of your testimony so that when we transcribe the minutes, we'll have that available? And I want to assure you that the reason that the task force was extended was so that we could look at some of the things that you suggested, and that is what the task force has been pursuing. So thank you very much.
Anchorage, this is Juno. Could you get a little closer to the mic? You're breaking up down here.
Mr. O'Clair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sister, you represent Providence Hospital. You suggested that possibly keeping the health care dollars in state. Do you have any specific ideas about how to do that?
Yes, I think the state health plan could encourage that health care, if it's provided within the state, be cared for in the state rather than going outside.
Do you have any suggestions on how that might be accomplished rather than just refusing to pay for bills that are incurred outside the state of Alaska for health care?
No, I really don't at this point.
Is Providence is that owned by a nationwide corporation or is it a local?
It's owned by a corporation with our headquarters in Seattle, Washington. We're part of a health care delivery system along the West Coast. Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California.
So the revenues that are earned here that are, say, profit,
they stay here within the state to care for people within this state.
So none of that goes to the outside corporation?
That's right, it does not.
Thank you very much.
Barbara?
Sister, you had talked in your presentation, had made a comment that we do not anywhere in the state of Alaska have a county health care services. Any ideas, or are you familiar with any programs in the lower 48 that maybe we could take a look at? And what are you looking at from a state or having each one of the municipalities sponsor such a thing?
There are county health delivery systems in a number of states. The one I'm most familiar with is California. And basically, some state funds are provided to each of the counties for the needs of people who cannot support themselves in terms of receiving health care. Also, the counties themselves need to come up with some funds, and so it's kind of a combination. Again, basically, patients who don't have the funds to care for themselves receive care in the county system, or if they go to a private hospital, the county reimburses that hospital. Thank you.
Garrett?
Just another follow-up on the county health system. My understanding of a county health system generally is that the county does provide through their clinic system some kinds of care that are non-acute care. That's very common in other states. The question I have about that relationship is the revenue sharing that you receive. Do you know how much revenue sharing you receive from the state?
Karen, I'm sorry, I don't have those numbers.
And the question I have is, what does your hospital view the revenue sharing that comes to you on a per bed basis as being used for? Is it indigent care or?
Yes, we basically use it for charity care. We use a great deal of it for the children in our neonatal intensive care. Many of those are long stay patients, families don't have the ability to put out that kind of money for that kind of care.
So it is so that the state does provide some funds for indigent care in a non-specific way through the revenue sharing on a bed basis.
Through the chair, Sister, if you could, what you talked in your presentation about one of the problems that you face is care, uncompensated care, if you will, and maybe a system to be able to take care of uncompensated care. What dollar amount or percent of your budget would you say it goes to taking care of uncompensated care?
Well, you probably need to define for me what you include in uncompensated care. If you mean charity care, if you mean bad debt, if you mean deductions, I think it's
well, let's separate charity from bad debt for a second. How much do you know how much you put
probably
in charity?
Probably charity care for us is probably close to 3.5%. Bad debt, it looks like this year it may be close to 5-6%.
And what is the
deductions are probably close to 16% of last year to date, and I would include in that Medicare, Medicaid, Veterans Administration.
When you say deductions, am I understanding that you mean care than that you're paid for at less than your standard rate? Is that what you're? And between Medicare, Medicaid, and VA benefits, what percent would that attribute of that?
About 16% at least your rate.
Right, but I mean, of the 16, how does that break down? I mean, is it half Medicare or is it half? Do you have any idea?
I don't have that number.
Do you have a sense maybe what it might be?
Well, probably.
If I could continue, what is your total operating budget for the hospital for, let's say, this last fiscal year?
Probably close to $80
million. $80 million? And what was the previous year, if I could ask?
Probably $75.
And what would you attribute to the difference, the increase? Is that increased utilization or new services you offered? Or?
We basically have seen increased volume this year, which does increase the expenses in terms of supplies, in terms of staff.
Okay. Have you, with other employers in the state, entered into preferred provider agreements?
We have very few preferred provider agreements here within the state.
Mm-hmm. And those that you have entered into, you say there's very few.
What
prompted those engagements?
One was an insurance company's interest because of the organizations he was covering. And
is that a specific
couple,
insurance company, if I could ask?
Blue Cross.
Okay.
The others have been at the desire and interest of major employers.
Has the Aetna insurance company approached you? And could I ask, do you know where those negotiations stand at this point?
I'm not sure what your question is.
My question, restated, would be, you've had discussions with Aetna for preferred providers. You've already agreed with Blue Cross to have a preferred provider arrangement, but as yet you have not with Aetna, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. What would you say of your hospital is the fastest growing area? I mean, if you took one segment of your hospital, what do you think, as far as services, is the fastest growing area? Is there a particular area?
Probably the whole area of maternal child.
Neonatal intensive, is that what you're saying?
Well, maternal child includes the obstetrics, the perinatal unit, includes labor delivery, pediatrics, newborn nursery, does include neonatal intensive care.
Mm-hmm. What about outpatient care for general?
We've seen an increase there, and I think we continue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'd like to move on to Kodiak and take the first participant at Kodiak, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is Jerome Selby. I'm the mayor of the Kodiak Island Borough here, who owns the hospital in Kodiak. I guess I have two primary things that I think the committee needs to consider in terms of a health care cost for the state of Alaska. First of all, I think that the primary thing the state of Alaska needs to do, if you really want to impact health care costs, is to put some upfront money into the facilities in the mid-sized communities like Kodiak to get our efficiency of and utilization of facility to the point where we can reduce the cost. As it is right now, we're in a facility that almost 10 years ago the state said was inadequate. We do not have anything in the way of fuel efficiency. We have high repair bills. Can't attract some of the expertise of specialties because we don't have the facility and the space in the facility to attract them. If we could do that, we could provide a whole lot more care in Kodiak. We could reduce the cost of transporting people out of here who don't really need to be going somewhere else. Just that we don't have the space or the facility or the specific expertise to provide that care. Unfortunately, the state of Alaska hasn't put money into facilities in 7 years now, the state of Alaska. That doesn't mean that the bill isn't growing. It means exactly that it is growing. If we would have funded one of these facilities, and there are several of them now in the state that we're aware of, over the last 5 years, if you would have funded one of them, say at $20 million a year, we'd be in pretty fair shape in the mid-sized communities today. As it is, we are looking at a bill that somebody's going to have to come up with $80 to $100 million here in the not-too-distant future. You simply won't have those mid-sized hospitals out here in rural Alaska, and you're going to have an even bigger cost to transport and care for people in the state. And I guess part of our concern goes beyond just the facility now. I don't know how many of you might have read the Newsweek magazine for September 3rd, but in that magazine, Alaska was fingered as having the worst health care out of the 50 states. Now, that damages us folks beyond just the health care system. That hurts our entire economy. Tourists take a look at that and say, well, wait a second. I was thinking about going to Alaska next summer, but if something should go wrong, that doesn't sound like someplace I want to be. I can't get any health care. I've had people here tell me that they had specialty things scheduled in Anchorage, but after they read that article, they're now going to Seattle. That damages us way beyond just an article in the Newsweek. It also makes it harder for us to attract business. Businesses that are thinking about locating in Anchorage or elsewhere in Alaska take a look at that and say, well, wait a second, maybe we can do it in Seattle and fly stuff back and forth. So there's a huge damage factor, in my view, to letting our healthcare facilities and our quality and availability continue to slide. Unfortunately, it has slid a lot in the last 7 years. The other factor, and that brings us to the rural aspect of this thing, is that in the last 4 years, we've not had any good coordination with the Alaska Native Health Service in terms of delivery of care in rural Alaska and developing a true system, healthcare system, that moves patients in a systematic manner from a village where the health aids are provided by the Alaska Native Health Service. There's been no effort to coordinate and make sure that those folks in the villages deliver the most possible care with the support by a physician that could be delivered in many areas. Some of those folks don't need to be coming into town that are if you would get a physician on the telephone and back up the health aid. But there's not been that kind of coordination in the last 4 years. Before that, there were initial efforts being made, and I was involved in that personally, to get the Alaska Native Health Service and the state of Alaska to look at the system on a systematic basis and improve it overall, coordinate, even do some co-funding. I know that maybe isn't a real popular idea in some of the bureaucracy, but folks were at least willing to talk about co-funding between the state and the federal government to improve the efficiency and actually develop an actual system of referring patients up from a village clinic to a mid-level hospital to be taken care of there, and if not, take it into your referral centers in Anchorage like Providence and Humana, and they'll ask an AFL service, depending on where the care could be provided, et cetera, et cetera. But we're paying a whole lot of extra money for transportation that we don't need to be spending just because we do not have an efficient system, and that comes back to a lack of coordination and cooperation. So those are the two factors that I'd certainly urge the committee to look very strongly at, and that's the idea of putting the money in up front for facilities in the mid-level communities that would substantially reduce the costs in these communities, improve the care and the amount of care available here, and reduce transportation. The second one, of course, is the coordination with the Alaska Native Health Service, particularly for a rural part of the state, and develop a true referral health care system. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Not, like to move on to Valdez and take the first participant in Valdez, please.
I don't have anything at this time, thank you.
Okay, we'll move back to Soldotna.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. This is Mike Lockwood. I'm the administrator at Central Peninsula General Hospital, and I'm speaking for the service area board and the hospital. I'd like to just make a couple comments on what Sister Donna had mentioned, and I apologize. We had a lot of that breakup, so I may be saying things that were already clarified. One of the major things that's driving our costs in healthcare here is the increase, of course, of our own health insurance and benefit structure. Over the last 4 years, our health plan has gone up over 250%. Our total benefit package has gone up over 100%, just about 100%, from $586,000 to $1,428,000. But the main thing that's affected us is the nursing shortage and bringing in qualified people to provide the care that's needed in our local community, and uncompensated care. I know that Sister Donna went to that in detail, but I'd like to give you a comparison of what's happening in a more rural location compared to what's happening in Anchorage. Our total uncompensated care has gone up 165% in the last 4 years. In fiscal year 86, it was $849,000. In fiscal year 90, the year we just completed, it was $2,416,000. The numbers vary. Uncollectibles went from $620,000 to $1,050,000. That's our bad debts. Charity went up from $50,000 to $347,000. Medicaid, Medicare went from $163,000 to almost $1 million. And others went up about five times, from $11,000 to $62,000. We get paid more from the federally utilization review affected program of Medicare on a percent of payments than we get from the Medicaid system. There's got to be something inherently wrong with that. Our payment systems in Alaska has been manipulated with time and time again, trying just to tighten down the payment schedule without a system of fairness and system of access. At Central Peninsula General Hospital, we care for all patients. When they come to our emergency department, we don't ask them how they're going to pay. We evaluate their health care needs and then worry about how they're going to pay after we've had an opportunity to triage them and look at them and see what their needs are. We have a strong support from the borough and from the service area board to provide care in that manner. The effect of cost containment on this hospital is an effect to the taxpayers of the borough. Our facility is owned by the borough and is supported through taxes in a service area district, and we continually get support there. And if things affect us to increase our uncompensated care, to increase that cost shift, it certainly has the effect of just making local taxable dollars. A comment on what happens to our revenue sharing is used through our service area budget to retire debt. The revenue sharing does not go to direct patient care. We attempt to keep our patient care costs of operations, specifically through operations. We have had a long-term program of productivity management through a system called MECON, but it's a system that we look at staffing through each individual utilization product line and through actually each procedure that's performed and the number of hours used for that procedure. We continue to look at different ways that we can enhance things to do them more efficiently. We've had a major shift to outpatient care from inpatient care. We now, in the last 3 months, we have had as much revenues from outpatient care as inpatient care, which is the first time in this in the history of this hospital. I've seen it grow to where when I came here 9 years ago, our revenues from outpatient was about 20% of the total revenues of the hospital, to where right now it's running at 50% of the total revenues for the hospital. I think, again, there was some comments about in the beginning about the concern for overbuilding. I don't see that as a real problem in Alaska in the rural areas. I know that that's been some problems in the Anchorage Bowl. I think it can be directly shown to a failure of the CON program and strengthening certificate of need. I don't think we'll have any impact on that, because in the issue when Humana and Providence built, there was a recommendation from the local health planning board in Anchorage to the commissioner to build one project and not the other, and then the commissioner of health and social services decided to allow both projects to be built. So it was a state decision to overbuild in Anchorage, not a individual hospital decision that was not under control of that. Both hospitals were competing for bed space. They put in competing certificate of needs, and there was a logical decision made by the planning commission. I can't think of the right name of the committee right now, but in Anchorage, that was submitted to the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, who is not our current commissioner, by the way, and they did not follow that wish. In rural Alaska, I think the issue is different. A lot of our structures are built at minimum sizing able to meet the needs of our community. We see variances in census from 1 to 2 patients in our hospital, up to 35 patients in our hospital. So we have to have the bed space to take care of those acute swings. I think if we can make the system work like Mayor Selby was talking about, so that we can better utilize the space we have, we're gonna have lower costs to the consumer and lower costs to the health plan. The last comment I would like to make is that as far as the numbers of the increase in the health system, health insurance system for the state employees, my personal opinion is one of the big impacts that's happened is the amount of people that have taken early retirement and have opted into the PERS system or have gotten that health benefit of that retirement program, and then those employees that have been replaced, I know all of them haven't, but some have, and then you get two people as participants in the plan where there was only one. It certainly saved the money, and I think it was appropriate decisions for the state to try to use that as a method to downsize the state government. But on the other hand, they needed to recognize the impact that would have in the other line items of the budget and be prepared to deal with that. And I think part of this that's happening right now is a reaction to that. Last but not least is that if we look at healthcare in Alaska on a discharge-based basis, not on a basis of a per-day expense, Alaska's costs are right in the middle of the United States. One of the comments to that is saying, well, that's because our population is younger. If you look at my facility and if you look at other facilities in Alaska, and I have access to numbers from 4 of those because I'm with Lutheran Health Systems that were managed by them. But by looking at those, our length of stay for Medicare is significantly less than the national average and significantly less than the West Coast average. So we're even being more efficient, doing better utilization in those areas. And so I think as you speak to better utilization review, there ought to be some time spent studying what we're already doing. My personal opinion that new utilization review programs are not going to bring back that much cost saving. I think programs that choose Alaska, programs that have a higher coinsurance from the employee when they choose to go outside of Alaska, so we can make better use of the facilities and the specialists we already have is the answer that we should look for. Thank you.
Your average occupancy rate is by those two?
Clinical dependency is running about 55 to 60%, and the acute care beds are running at 48%.
And has that trend continued over the last 3-4 years, or is that?
We've actually seen a lowering utilization of the acute care beds and the increase in outpatient utilization.
Might seem like an ignorant question, but we talked about overbuilding, and you said that wasn't a factor, but what I hear is that you have a 48% occupancy. That would just tend to lead a layman down the path that seems like a little bit of overbuilding.
Well, I think that you ought to come here when I have the place full, and we're thinking about where to put the patient in the hallway on the, when we have that 50% increase in patient load on a busy day. The problem that you have in rural facilities is we have major swings in occupancy. We may have a month. I'll speak to my med-surg unit. My med-surg unit has 30 beds in it. We may have a month in med-surg where I only have one or two patients. We may have another day in med-surg where I'm up to where I have 28 or 29 patients. I am having several periods of time where I have to take patients from my perinatal unit and put them on the OB on the med-surg unit because I don't have enough room in that to hit our peak census days. We do have difficulties because of that swing, and that's typical of small rural hospitals throughout the United States.
I understand. Could you tell us what your total revenues were for fiscal 89 or 90 either?
90 was, I don't have that number in front of me, it was about 12.5 million. So we're looking at the total uncompensated care was about 20% of revenues.
Barbara? We're talking, or made a comment in your presentation there towards the end regarding increased co-payments or deductibles for the employees that were receiving services. My understanding on that statement was basically an incentive if they decided to go for care down the lower 48 that you'd increase the cost, i.e. more of a penalty for that employee making that choice. My question to you, where do you save money if the only reason that that employee or that covered individual under the plan is going to the lower 48 to begin with is because the cost and the service is cheaper?
I think that isn't the reason the employee is making that decision. And I'm only speaking to services that are provided also locally. There's a lot of reasons for people to go outside. They go outside because family members are there. They have more support. Alaska is very a lot of people in Alaska are here without the whole family infrastructure. And I think those are the kind of things that are making the choice, at least in my experience here in South Central Alaska. The decisions, I think, need to be made on a per-discharge basis if it's a cost decision that drives that. But if we want to have, in Alaska, a neonatal intensive care unit, and people make choices to go out because the charge is less, that means the charge, the cost per patient is going to go up for the people that stay. If we make choices to go outside for chemical dependency treatment because the charge is less, that means that the same thing. You have an infrastructure that you've already built here in the state. We try to make our prices competitive. In our chemical dependency unit, our prices are very competitive. We use a system right now in our hospital where we charge our employees a higher co-insurance when they choose to go to Anchorage or when they choose to go outside. If the care is provided here, they should get it here. If the care is not provided here and they need it in Anchorage, we direct them to the hospital that is our experience is the lowest cost of the two hospitals. And if they choose to go to the other hospital, they have to pick up more of the payment. And I think cost has to be considered in that, but you also need to understand that we have a very, very friable system here. We have VA and ANS and different systems in the state, and when you take some of that away, it can have an impact of increasing the cost to everybody else.
Thank you.
Hey, Mike, you mentioned huge fluctuations in the medical surgical beds.
Yes.
What is there a cause that you can point to for that? I mean, could you level that out if you had to by scheduling, since some of that surgery could probably be done on a little different time frame? Some of it obviously has to be done when it has to be done, but others of it is, I'm sure, must be selective.
Yeah, we are doing that right now. We have just recruited a second general surgeon into the community, so we have a general surgeon here all the time. But we find a lot of the fluctuation is in communities when you only have one specialist and that person leaves town, your census responds to that. We try to impact that with looking at that with our staffing ratios at the same time. We are trying to attempt that, but not all hospitals can do that. You know, if your surgeon or your orthopedist or your ear, nose, and throat guy aren't in town, then those procedures can't be done and you aren't as highly utilized.
Thank you. Imagine the problem's a lot worse if they're all in town at the same time.
That's when we get the high numbers. That also makes us much more efficient, so I'm not sure that I call the problem worse. We'd like to see it that way all the time.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'd like to next go back to Anchorage here and take the next participant, Steve Berkshire. I'm also at this time going to turn the chair over to the current chair of the task force, Senator Jim Duncan.
My name's Steve Berkshire. I'm the administrator for North Star Adolescent Hospital here in Anchorage. It's a 34-bed adolescent psychiatric and chemical dependency facility. What I'd like to talk about is a little bit different than the general acute care hospitals, and I guess to start with, since one of the issues is whether or not there ought to be managed care, is to indicate that the psychiatric industry is much more used to that, I suppose, in that case managers is an up-and-coming thing and is around all the time. It's our feeling that the case management aspect of managed care is probably appropriate, that it helps determine that, yes, the level of care is appropriate, that the continuing stay is probably appropriate. What we'd like to see is that the payment follow that process. If the third-party carrier says that, yes, we think that patient needs to be in this facility or they need other care, that they go ahead and pay for it. One of the things that we would like to see, however, is that there needs to be reasonable criteria that are understandable to the providers. Psychiatric services can't be defined as readily as, yes, somebody needs surgery, or no, they don't, it can wait. There's often a lot of subjective judgments as to what is appropriate or not appropriate. One of the problems that I think that we see in this business is that it's real hard sometimes going from one third-party managed care system to another to know what to expect and what not to expect. The other thing that occurs is that there's often the impression that services can be provided on an outpatient basis, that just because somebody has a mental health issue, obviously inpatient care is appropriate, and that's not always true. Often, and there are studies nationally that show that if you can start somebody off very quickly in a controlled environment, that they're going to be much more successful on an outpatient basis. The issue comes is that often the payment doesn't follow that. That it may well be that a day program or an outpatient might be appropriate, but then there's no payment for it. The third parties will pay for 50% of the inpatient care, but they won't pay for anything on the outpatient or day program, or they'll pay for 50% up to $1,500 a year, our lifetime maximum. I think that's a real issue. Several providers have tried to start day programs, and a day program or partial hospitalization program is one in which a patient either can be stepped down from the inpatient side, so instead of perhaps an adolescent having to stay for 60 or 90 days to solve their particular problem, they might be able to be discharged within a couple of weeks or maybe 3-week period of time. They could go to a day program because they're now capable of living in a foster home or going home for their parents. In most cases, the insurance coverage isn't there. They'll say, yeah, we'll treat that as an outpatient. So you get $25 a day for a cost of $250 a day, and it's not reasonable to do that. The other thing that needs to follow is that in most cases with adolescents or even adults that are in chemical dependency, maybe other issues, is that family services are quite important. I think most of the studies now show you that that if you involve the family in the treatment process, that you're going to have much more success with that. Some of the things that may affect the utilization of psychiatric services in Alaska, I think, that need to be looked at that probably don't exist elsewhere in the country. Obviously, one of them is our isolation, the number of villages that we have, people can't get to them, the social functions that occur to that. There's been some recent studies since 1988, and I can get you the studies themselves later, I didn't bring them with me, where suicide rates, for example, when you take them age-specific in this state, exceed the national average by at least 4 times. If you take a look at the native male rate of suicide, one study was done by Forbes and Vanderhyde, I believe it was, showed that the suicide rate for age-specific kids was about over 200 per 100,000. That's a tragedy in a state of like Alaska, which could be treating those kids. The homicide rate for Alaska native females is 6 times the national average. Injuries exceed the national average again, and most of those injuries are self-inflicted or inflicted by others. The divorce rate is 60% higher in this state. There are a lot of child abuse issues. There's a lot of breakup issues. One study that took a look at the inpatient population for adolescents showed that the majority of those kids had moved 3 times in the last year that they were in treatment. So there's a lot of family issues that we need to take a look at. And I believe the consumption of alcohol in the state is about 48% higher than the national average. All of those gone together would indicate that there's a tremendous need that's not being met. Most of the state health planning studies in the mental health field show that there's a tremendous need for community mental health services, which we agree. But there needs to be that backup to provide that to them. The other issue that can be addressed is the tendency for the payment system, whether it's CHAMPIS, Medicaid, third-party carriers, all of them, is the assumption that conduct disorders, behavioral disorders of adolescents are a criminal issue. That kids that get in trouble obviously ought to be in jail or McLaughlin. And unfortunately, in this state, that seems to be the only way many of them do get treatment, is they have to get arrested first. Granted that there are issues where conduct disorders or behavioral ones could be treated on an outpatient basis, but again, we think that the case management system, if taking a look at those kids, can determine early on that, yes, a couple of weeks in a controlled environment where you can get the behavior under control, they're going to be more successful on an outpatient basis, is the way to go. And we ought to take a look at that whole continuum of services. The other thing that needs to be taken a look at, I think, that would help reduce, eventually, it's not going to be one that you're going to see a major result in 6 months, is that a lot of the national studies that come out from the National Association of Private Psychiatric Hospitals and the National Institutes of Mental Health would indicate that if you intervene early on with a person's mental health problem, whether it's chemical dependency, psychosomatic illnesses, stress, that you'll probably have an impact upon the cost of medical surgical services down the road. And again, that's a long-term benefit that you're not going to see in 6 months, but it's one to take a look at. Just to support what Sister and Mike Lockwood have indicated, is that cost shifting is probably a major problem throughout the country. Recent estimates, I think, show that about 30 million Americans are underinsured or not insured. They don't qualify for Medicaid, and they're not, and their health care services aren't being paid for. When those people need health care services, that means those that do have insurance, basically the employers of this country, are paying for that cost. And I think, along with Sister, that taking a look at a system in the state of Alaska, which probably has some unique opportunities, how do you get those other populations to come in under a system would be very beneficial. I think those are all the comments that I have for today, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Barbara?
Mr. Chair, I guess my first question, have you had any dealings or familiar with managed mental health programs?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you
probably about 98% of our patients are under some sort of utilization review managed health care, meaning that there's an agency such as August International or HMS, which does CHAMPIS, or the PRO, where we have to call prior to admission, to justify why that admission is necessary unless it's an emergency, meaning that they're attempted suicide or they're actively suicidal or they're dangerous to themselves or others. And then to follow that up on an ongoing basis, showing what treatment's being provided and whether or not that stage needs to continue.
So is that done then as a recommendation? How do they get into your facility? Is it a recommendation that's made through the third party out there, Human Affairs?
In some cases, it might be from a referral source to the hospital that the person needs to be admitted. If it comes directly from Human Affairs, then the assessment's been done. If it's a referral from a mental health professional, then typically we would have to call the review agency and review the case with them prior to admission.
Have you had any negative, positive results in participating in that kind of program?
It depends upon the particular agency you call, and then sometimes on the individual that answers the phone as to whether you have problems or you don't have problems. I think overall our experience has been positive. It's been time-consuming, and it creates a lot of problems that the healthcare professionals spend a lot of time on the phone. It's as if the more you can require the person to be on the phone and you have to get the physician to come in and sit down and talk to them on the phone, that the likelihood is you'll finally give up and say, the heck with it, we won't admit the kid, or we'll discharge them earlier than we need to, and they'll go home. That seems to be more the problem than our ability to justify why they need to be there.
I don't know if you'd be able to answer this, or even how long you've been participating in these type of programs. If you can, do you feel it's been a cost-effective having those type of programs put into an insurance plan? It was something that the task force had talked about initially a year ago. It's not been implemented within the state plan, but it is something that we're currently looking at with the municipality. Any?
I think initially they do have a cost-effective benefit, if only from the perspective that what it does is it causes the employer and the individuals that are insured under that benefit plan to think twice about what services they need and where they need those. I think it helps from the perspective of taking a look at what's the best point of access and the continuum of services for an individual. The problem that has come about is that the continuum always isn't paid for. That perhaps the only alternative is the inpatient side, not the outpatient, or partial hospitalization is another alternative. And those aren't paid for, or there's no benefits there for them, so you have no other choice but the inpatient admission. So I think that's probably the major problem with it. It becomes less efficient as more obstacles are put in place. So at this time, for example, you may call, and this is an example with Champus's new program, that when they started, it was fairly easy to justify why a suicidal kid needed to be in the hospital. Lately, it's become much more difficult. They say, well, was there an active case where they attempted the suicide, or are they just suicidal? And if there's they actively tried to, then it's easier. If they're suicidal and all healthcare professionals say, if you let them out on the street by themselves, the likelihood is they could do it, but you can't prove that they'll do it, then they'll say, well, try outpatient. Then you're taking a real chance that something could happen to that adolescent while they're out in the street. And then who's going to be liable for it? So it gets to be kind of tricky, and I think that's where it's becoming less cost efficient, is that you're spending more and more time trying to justify what's going on. The agencies probably could work closer with the providers and perhaps certify that your own internal programs are working well, and if they believe that with periodic sampling and checks, then perhaps it would make it easier to do that.
One more question. You'd also talked about the daycare programs. Excuse me. The day programs. Do you currently have such a program in existence, or do you know if there's any that are being offered here in the state?
Yeah. We have one. I think Charter North has a day program.
Can I interrupt your other people online? I understand the other people online are having a hard time listening to the MSU State Board directly into those microphones.
there are two private day programs in existence. The other day programs are in the community mental health centers or in the state-funded alcohol programs. They get state funds to do it, and they seem to be able to operate fairly well. That hasn't extended yet to the private programs where you're dependent upon private insurance dollars, private pay, and Medicaid doesn't pay for them at all in a private facility. Hopefully that'll change down the road. So that the problem becomes then making sure that they can operate economically and efficiently, because it's hard to get patients qualified to be in the day program. It's easier to get them qualified to be an inpatient.
And is that because it's such a new thing and your insurance carriers or the individuals out there paying for these are not recognizing these as efficient or effective programs?
Right.
Thank you.
Jeff, did you have...
Oh, excuse me. Did you give us the average length of stay?
I think I flip it on.
Did you give us the average length of stay for an inpatient and the average length of treatment for an outpatient?
The average length of stay at our hospital for adolescents is decreased from about 36.5 days last year, and it's averaging about 29 days this year. For an outpatient, it could be anywhere from a couple of visits to several years, depending upon what the particular issue is with the person. And I don't have any statistics on that, since they're seeing private practitioners.
Well, over a given period of time, let's say the last 5 years, have those statistics varied appreciably in your opinion?
The inpatient length of stay has decreased substantially, I would say, over the last 5 years. Adolescents have probably gone from 50, 60 days to 45 down to close to 30 days this past year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. If I could you tell us what your revenues were in 1989?
1989, I believe they were somewhere around $2.3 million, maybe $2.5.
Okay, and is any... What percent of your business, if any, is uncompensated care?
I believe it was about 20% that year.
And what would you attribute that to? Is it bad debt?
Bad debt, I believe, is only about 2.8% of ours. The rest of it, in 1989, we weren't eligible for Medicaid, so it was all underpayments from insurance companies where they weren't paying the full price, and we made decisions that the family couldn't afford either all of it or parts of it, and we forgave a lot of that, as well as cases that were in the hospital for free.
Charity care. What would you project your revenues to be in your fiscal 90?
Fiscal year 90, they were about 2.5 billion, I believe. I'd have to look at it. This coming year is what you were talking about, the year that we're in.
Right.
Hopefully, they'll be around 3 million.
But what do you attribute to that increase?
Increased utilization of the hospital.
I see on a certificate of need status report that you've been applied for and received a temporary certificate of need for acute psychiatric care. Could you explain that to me?
When the hospital opened in 1987, their intent was to offer psychiatric services in addition to their chemical dependency services for adolescents. After they met the standards for such, the state... We asked the state whether or not a certificate of need was necessary to provide psychiatric services, and at that time the determination was that it wasn't, due to the fact that it was an additional service under the same license, and there wasn't $1 million threshold met for capital expenditures. It was only $125,000. Charter North Hospital challenged that and asked for a hearing on that issue, and the hearing was held this past, finished up this summer, in September. And the hearing officer said that the state erred in not requiring a certificate of need, and the commissioner adopted that that opinion from the hearing officer. We did file an appeal to the Superior Court, but agreed that we'd go ahead and file for the certificate of need, providing we had a temporary one in the meantime to allow operation, and that's what we're doing.
Okay. If I could, along back to the utilization review, by having this new requirement, or requirement of the last couple of years, to call a number and talk to a review position of some sort, do you feel that because there are a number of different people doing that, that has some impact on the cost, your cost of doing business?
It has an impact on the cost of doing business in that we've had to allocate an individual to do nothing, or almost nothing, but utilization review calls. So that's an added personnel cost, probably $25,000-$30,000 of that person's time. It also takes up the time of the physician when the psychiatrist has to interact with the review agency themselves, when the clerk, or the, in some cases they're clerks, other cases they're social workers, that might be psychiatric nurses, don't feel that they can competently decide, and then they have to talk to the physician, so there's that cost in there.
What's your average occupancy?
This past year was just about 60%.
Okay, any further questions, Karen?
Steve, something along the lines of what Jeff asked about, specifically about Aetna, as the new changes have come in for pre-authorization. We have a report showing that inpatient psychiatric expenses declined by 40.5% per employee, and substance abuse charges decreased by 28, almost 30% over, I think it's the quarter. My question to you is, beyond the normal restrictions that pre-authorization brings, what are you seeing with Aetna clients in terms of admission? Finding that those are appropriate compared to other pre-authorizations?
I'd have to take a look at what years the statistics were for. But our experience has been there's a lot of different plans for Aetna, and depending
this is for
upon
state
the,
employees.
Okay, depending upon
and for the quarter,
yeah.
I believe.
Okay.
For
6 months.
Months.
For 6 months. Our experience with the state employees that have been referred for treatment hasn't been that it's any more difficult to get them qualified for admission or continued stay than some of the other third parties. And I don't know which managed care system the state employees are using right now, so I can't tell you, you know, that one. I know a couple of them that are difficult to deal with, and they're not under a managed care system.
Well, but we do have, I think we instituted pre-authorization for psychiatric stay and probably continued review over that period. So I was, you've answered my question, George.
Okay, anything further? Any questions? Thanks.
Okay, we'll go back to the teleconference sites and make one more round. I believe there's another individual to testify in Soldotna, is that correct?
Dennis Murray is here to testify.
Thank you, go ahead.
Good morning, members of the committee, and appreciate the opportunity to testify concerning the efforts of the Cost Containment Task Force. I just wanted to make the point that the
excuse me, could you identify yourself for the record and who you're representing?
Yes, Dennis Lurie. I'm the administrator of Heritage Place, the nursing facility in Soldotna. And I wanted to make my comments very brief. I think it's very important to look at existing services and facilities in terms of cost containment, in the sense that any facilities that are converted or changed from this point in time, in many cases, only make it more difficult for existing facilities to continue to operate, particularly where, you know, there are areas that have excess capacity. Certainly in Anchorage, the acute care facilities there have, at the present time, a significant amount of beds available, and I think that the committee needs to look at the whole structure of how healthcare is delivered, not only in community hospitals, but also the other agencies of the government, in terms of the combination of services that are available look at that in light of the increased costs in the last few years. I think, too, that the whole question of civil liability is an issue that the committee needs to look at in terms of how our society looks at the liabilities that are part of the delivery of health care, and what at what cost is the present system, and how does it service? Does it serve the citizens as well as it could? And does it increase disproportionately the cost of health care for the benefit that it might to give to some who would benefit from the litigation that arises out of health care issues? So I think that's an important matter for the committee, and it's a cost containment issue, along with the questions of of facility expansion and other kinds of related matters. And I appreciate the opportunity this morning to speak with the committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Jeff?
If you could, I'm not familiar with your facility. Are you a long-term care facility? Or?
That's correct. Skilled and intermediate care.
And how many beds do you have?
45.
And what kind of occupancy do you have?
We've been fluctuating somewhere between 24 residents, and today we have 29, so about 56 to 65% occupied.
Mm-hmm. And have you been seeing an increased need in your area for long-term care beds, or?
Well, certainly we're not at capacity. There is a need. There's a question certainly of different ways in which we finance long-term care in the state that has an impact. Where we see the unmet need is for those persons who do not qualify for Medicaid, but for whom they have already exhausted their resources, and they basically have an income which precludes them from being eligible for public benefits. And I think that's the group of persons that are underserved and unserved in the present delivery system. And I think, too, that when we compare costs between, the various mechanisms we have for long-term care, that it gets pretty confusing as to what costs more or less. We do see a situation where people who do not qualify for Medicaid are, by necessity, to preserve their situation, apply at our Pioneer Home system. And unfortunately, currently, the system has a tremendous amount of waiting list in the Anchorage facility and the Palmer facility. So those persons are really unserved at the present time. And we're advocating that the state take a look at that issue and try to come up with a solution that helps people remain in their own communities closer to their support system, and obviously we're looking at utilization of Heritage Place as an option for that.
Thank you.
Karen?
This is Karen Perdue, just to follow up a little bit elaborate on what Dennis said. More than 30 states have what's called a medically needy program under Medicaid, which allows you to exhaust your benefits every month and then become eligible for services, sort of a catastrophic backup type program. Those of us who have state pensions or pensions, no matter if we have zero resources, will never more than likely qualify for Medicaid, whether we have an acute care trauma or a long-term care experience, because we simply will never be able to exhaust that $1,042 a month or whatever it is in the pension that isn't allowing us to spend down. So what many states have done to deal with a part of the uncompensated care issue is to adopt a medically needy program.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Dennis. Is there anyone in Valdez left who wants to testify?
I'd just like to mention, this is Dan Muller. I'm the administrator of the Valdez Hospital. The Valdez Hospital is a 15-bed hospital. And I'd like to mention that one of our primary concerns as we're looking at our budget mentioned, we're a 15-bed hospital. We have a total of 35 employees full and part-time. And for us to compete with the state as far as just health insurance by itself, that's going to cost us over $100,000 next year. Our budget for this year was $1,400,000. So you can see that that has a major impact on us. We're talking about the cost of health care and the benefits that state employees receive.
Okay, any comments or questions? Anyone? Thank you very much. Let's go back to Kodiak. Is there someone still in Kodiak to testify?
Yes, good morning, thank you. My name is John Saldus. I'm the administrator of the hospital here in Kodiak. When the committee looks at this, you'll have to recognize some things that are probably unique about some of the communities in Alaska. Kodiak is not alone. We're part of many communities with the same problem, and that is the staffing or relocation issue for employees. We have new employees that come on board to recruit professional employees in the lower 48 is a very expensive venture. Not only the recruitment of them, but the moving costs to get them up here. That is part of health care costs. And to have quality people, you have to attract the good people, and the good people require moving expenses be paid. It's just not possible for them to do it. You have to handle that. Another thing is, there is a core staffing issue that has to be addressed in all the hospitals. We're a 25-bed hospital. Our occupancy fluctuates from 5 patients a day up to 24 patients a day. But even with those 4 or 5 patients a day, you still require a certain staffing level minimum to handle the emergencies, to handle OBs, to handle critical care patients. You can't, if you ever got down to where, we never have, but if you ever got down where you had 0 patients, you can't close the doors. It's just not possible. So you have a certain cost factor that's built in that has to be covered. One of the issues that I think this state is going to have to address and quickly is a comprehensive state health plan. It's, to me, totally incomprehensible that the state has not taken the initiative in the last 4 or 5 years to develop a comprehensive plan that addresses all the facets of healthcare within the state, not just the private sector, but also the public sector, as well as the native sector. They are all part of the healthcare system, and until they are integrated, you are not going to see very much of a reduction in healthcare costs. It's just not possible. Thank you.
Okay, any questions from the committee members? Okay, thank you, Mr. Solanis. There are no questions. Anyone else in Kodiak who wants to testify?
No, no one else, thank you.
All right, how about Homer? Apparently not. Is there someone in Juneau who wanted to testify?
Juneau, and there's no one here to testify.
Okay. Anyone on any of the sites? I think I've run through all of them. Anyone left on any teleconference sites who is interested in testifying to the committee this morning?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dennis Murray again. I have the opportunity. I had two more points to make.
Sure, go ahead, Dennis.
I think in terms of cost containment, the other issue is one of regulation. In long-term care right now, we're undergoing a significant regulatory change from the federal level. It's commonly referred to as OBRA 87, which is the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. But in that act, the federal government mandated tremendous changes in the way in which long-term care delivers care, and that has a cost impact. And many times there's a conflict, or at least there's a confusion. between both state and federal regulatory schemes, and that increases the cost. It has a tremendous effect, and the expectation, in other words, for what is to be delivered, does not have congruence with the willingness to pay for the service. And so regulation and the plethora of regulation is part of the reason that healthcare costs in long-term care, at least, have increased and will continue to increase. Another issue that I think is important, and Mr. Salmas brought it up indirectly, is the cost of bringing people to the state, of professional people in various skilled areas. And I think that cost containment should also include an examination of how well or what we are doing as a state in terms of education at the post-secondary level. What are we doing to expand, if you will, the Alaskans who have skills and who are available to fill jobs? Unfortunately, many hospitals and some nursing homes have had to hire at great expense staff, buy-in staff, and that increases the cost of health care. And it seems that, again, that comprehensive health care planning would include a significant effort on the part of higher education to put in place the career ladder ideas. Several years ago, for example, our state eliminated the LPN program, and that program is desperately needed as a career ladder for people starting out in long-term care, resident assistants, and long-term care continues to use LPNs. Hospitals